In a September 2019 edition of The Atlantic, Derek Thompson wrote the following: "The idea of American exceptionalism has become so dubious that much of its modern usage is merely sarcastic. But when it comes to religion, Americans really are exceptional. No rich country prays nearly as much as the U.S., and no country that prays as much as the U.S. is nearly as rich. America's unique synthesis of wealth and worship has puzzled international observers and foiled their grandest theories of a global secular takeover. In the late 19th century, an array of celebrity philosophers, the likes of Friedrich Nietzsche, Karl Marx, and Sigmund Freud, proclaimed the death of God and predicted that atheism would follow scientific discovery and modernity in the West, sure as smoke follows fire. Stubbornly pious Americans threw a wrench in the secularization thesis. Deep into the 20th century, more than 9 in 10 Americans said they believed in God and belonged to an organized religion, with the great majority of them calling themselves Christian. That number held steady through the sexual revolution of the 60s, through the rootless and anxious 70s, and through the greed is good 80s. But in the early 1990s, the historical tether between American identity and faith snapped. Religious non-affiliation in the U.S. started to rise and rise and rise. By the early 2000s, the share of Americans who said they didn't associate with any established religion, also known as nones, had doubled. By the 2010s, this grab bag of atheists, agnostics, and spiritual dabblers had tripled in size. History does not often give the satisfaction of a sudden and lasting turning point. History tends to unfold in messy cycles, actions and reactions, revolutions and counter-revolutions, and even semi-permanent changes are subtle and glacial. But the rise of religious non-affiliation in America looks like one of those rare historical moments that is neither slow, nor subtle, nor cyclical. You might call it exceptional. The obvious question is, what the hell happened around 1990? So what did happen in the 1990s? Well, the short answer is a lot. We began the 1990s with the fall of the Soviet Union and ended it with the Y2K bug hysteria. Shortly after that, 9/11, and a lot of stuff happened in between. The Los Angeles riots, the first Gulf War on the earlier end. By the end of the 1990s, most people had an email address, and nobody knew what one was before the beginning of the 1990s. We had the World Wide Web. There was a lot going on in the 1990s, and this period of time was transformative for a lot of reasons. One of the interesting elements of the 1990s is that it was a really big time for conspiracy theories, not in the same way that conspiracy theories exist today, not in the kind of Alex Jones sort of way, but more in a your regular everyday person was really into the idea of UFOs. There was a lot of UFO shows happening in the 1990s. And a lot of that was a reflection of the changing nature of religion and religiosity, the fears around the radical shifts in technology and science in the 1990s. Trust in government was on the decline, and paranoia and fear were on the rise. And all of this was best tapped into by the show that would define the zeitgeist of the 1990s, The X-Files, and particularly the relationship between its two protagonists, Fox Mulder and Dana Scully. I'm John Brooks, and this is Hard to Believe. Hello, and welcome to the first episode of Hard to Believe. I am John Brooks, as I said in the intro. And with me, appropriately, is my very first podcasting partner, Joey Lewandowski. Hey, Joey.
Hello. Hello, hello. Yes, indeed. All the way back in 2012, I think, before you were a dad.
I was thinking about that. It was before... It was like the time of podcasts equivalent to like when the World Wide Web was just like a bunch of people's favorite bands, right? Like it was before, I think it was around the time of Serial, and I think like Serial is when people were like, oh, podcasts, that's a thing that will happen. But we were just recording stuff into microphones and putting it on the internet, and we had no idea what the hell a podcast was supposed to be. So
believe it or not, so that was back in 2012, I think, like I said. In 2005, I had a friend, maybe 2006, I had a friend that I was playing Halo with every day. He's like, we should start a Harry Potter podcast. And I was like, who would ever want to listen to us talk about Harry Potter? And I'm still asking the same question. Who would ever want to listen to us talk about Nicolas Cage or whatever? But, you know, 2006 would have been, like, very truly the early days. Like, when Apple first launched, you know, the podcast store or whatever they called it back then, you know, as part of iTunes. Like, my friend was like, we should do this. And I was like, okay, but why? And now, you know, I often think if I had done that and that had taken off, like, I would have met probably by now, you know, J.K. Rowling and Daniel Radcliffe. And then, like, imagine, like, because I can't believe there was a Harry Potter podcast before then, right? Like, if I had stuck with it, I could be a millionaire right now. I could have, like, all sorts of famous friends.
Are the Harry Potter podcasters millionaires?
No. Right. I mean, I know, no, but maybe. I could have been.
Are any podcasters millionaires?
Yeah, Joe Rogan, Mark Maron's probably not, but yeah, Joe Rogan is.
That's true. Anyway, this is a new podcast. This is the first episode of a brand new podcast, and this podcast was inspired by my various appearances on your podcasts. If you don't know, Joey usually has me come in to speak on his podcasts, which include, oh, they are various. You want to name some of them that I've been on, and some of them.
So
that
the ones
like?
That you've been on, Cage Club, our Nicolas Cage podcast. You've been on Keanu Club, our Keanu Reeves podcast. I think you've been on Watch the Throne, our Charlize Theron. Oh, you're on our lost episode of the Cider House Rules for our Charlize Theron podcast.
Yeah,
Watch
right.
the Throne. You've been on Cruise Club, our Tom Cruise podcast. You've been on Hanks for the Memories, our Tom Hanks podcast. All in all, I think now, including this one, we have like 27 shows on the network. I run like, or I host like 12 of them, I think. They're not all active in production right now, but we are putting out, you know, 35 or 40 episodes a month. And those you can find all at cageclub.me and wherever you find fine podcasts.
Wherever quality podcasts are sold. And every time that there's some sort of religious, philosophical component, I tend to be on those shows, and because that's what I do for a living. I teach religion, not in the way that like a priest does, in the way that like a teacher does. So I was on a bunch of those, and I decided why not have a podcast that talks about the intersection of pop culture and religion and mystical, philosophical, weird things of the past, and so forth. So I decided to let Joey pick the first topic and make it as broad as possible. And Joey, your response to me was what?
Oh, okay.
A loud cough. We'll take that in post. It's fine.
Yeah, it's just the virus. It's fine. When you said to me, you know, just pick a topic, I was like, I don't even know where to begin, because like I'm interested to see where this podcast goes, because I feel like of all the shows on the network, of all the shows that I listen to, this has the most potential to go in any number of different ways. Like, it's all under a singular umbrella and it's all within your focus and within your reach, but it's also like, oh, I don't know what any of this is actually going to wind up being. And so there's a couple different shows. Like, I think before I mention the thing that is probably the title of this episode that people already know, like, why are you beating around the bush? One of my favorite things in movies and TV shows is when religion is the intersection of religion and, I guess, non-believers, kind of. And I don't know why that scratches such an itch for me, but, like, you know, maybe my three favorite shows of all time, and these are basically the three of the ideas that I had to talk about with you tonight, The Leftovers, Lost, and The X-Files, they all deal to a small or to a great extent about religion and belief and, you know, what does that all mean, and should you, and is it dumb to do so, or is it good to do so, and, like, are you right, are you dumb? Like, it doesn't, like, all of that different things, you know, man of science, man of faith, and whether they're movies that are just singular stories or, like, ongoing narratives like Lost or like The Leftovers or whatever that have to do with religion, you know, I don't know why that scratches such an itch for me, but it always does. And, I've a lot on my brain lately. I've been thinking about the X-Files a lot lately, and I don't know why, but I think maybe because I'm always kind of thinking about the X-Files, and the more I think about it, it's probably my favorite show of all time. And I know that you have a history with it. I'm assuming, I think we've talked about it before. I think you really like it too. I guess we'll find out. I guess I'll find out shortly. But one of the things that, especially early on, I don't know that it really continued as the show went on, because I think it became other things. But one of the things that really fascinated me early on is Gillian Anderson's character, Dana Scully, being a scientist, being this woman of science, and yet she still is a woman of faith, and like she has the necklace, and the cross necklace, and her dad, and like when her dad dies, spoiler, in the first season, like she doesn't really know where to go to deal with this, because she like logically and rationally knows one thing, but also spiritually kind of wants to know another one. And so I kind of want to talk about that with you and sort of hear what you have to think about that, but also kind of in like maybe in a broader way, just the intersection of like how do people either on TV or in movies or in real life that are so by the book, scientific numbers, pure rationality, thinking, whatever, also be like, yeah, but also like religion matters to me. Like I understand to a certain extent like why how that happens in real life, but I just think it's a fascinating topic, especially the way that, this character is created.
Yeah. So, first of all, I want to. You're like 10 years younger than me, maybe. So, what was your sort of introduction to the X-Files? Like, where did it fit in your life growing up? You would have been very young while it was still on the air. So talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so I was born in 87, the end of 80s, December 87, and started in September 93. So I was almost 6 when it started. I remember either season 5 or 6, so I think after the movie had come out, my dad and I started watching it on TV. So I would have been 11 or 12, which I feel like is maybe just a touch too young. I remember having horrible nightmares from one episode in particular. Just like, I was like, oh no, this is terrible. And then one of my first big expensive purchases was when I think the season that the series had concluded, so I was probably 15 or something, and I had my first job. I remember Best Buy was selling the DVDs that were normally like $99 a season. I bought them, they were all half price, so I spent $450 on 9 seasons of DVD, 9 seasons of TV on DVD. And I remember that my dad and I, while I was in high school, would like go through, and I think, we probably watched the first 5 or 6 seasons that way. I think, actually, I might have started a little bit after that. I don't know. But I started watching with my dad toward the end, sort of the middle to the end, and saw the last couple seasons with him live, and then we caught up most of it. It's a show that I don't know for certain that I've seen all 202, 203, whatever it is, episodes of the original run. I think I've seen at the minimum, like 170, 180 of them, but I feel like there's stuff in like seasons 7 and 8, maybe, that I haven't. Like when Kumail had his X-Files file show, and Max Landis came on to talk about X-Cops, I was like, oh, I don't remember this at all, and X-Cops is amazing. So I think there's probably some like gaps in knowledge in later seasons, which sort of feels antithetical, but I feel like every couple of years I go back and I start watching from the beginning, and so I'm really, really familiar with the first few seasons. And I would say I know most of almost everything. I know all the narratives and everything like, but there's just like there's episodes probably toward the end that I haven't seen for one reason or another.
So I'm glad you brought up the X-Cops. I'd forgotten about that episode until you said it, and it immediately came right back into my head. The X-Files is in so many ways the 1990s, and looking back on it now, captures so much of what was going on in the 1990s, in a way that like it doesn't. I'm sure the show still holds up, and it's still a great show. But it really is a sort of relic of its time, in a way that it's very difficult to go tell someone who's never seen it to like go watch every episode, right? Because it doesn't, it is not timeless, but it is absolutely fantastic as a series. It's one of the best television series ever made. In a lot of ways, Battlestar Galactica was a show, the more recent one was a show that was very much a post 9/11 show, was very much a post Iraq war show. A lot of those themes and ideas are very clearly present in that show. The X-Files is a show that is of and about the sort of existential, angst of the 90s, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the X-Cops episode, which is an episode where it's like a handheld cam version of the X-Files, where it's basically an episode of the very 90s show Cops, which is why I'm glad you brought it up, which itself is like just so much what the 90s are is the show Cops, right? Like,
right.
Fox's, this upstart network is looking for like cheap shows and like, oh, we'll just have a bunch of police officers film themselves and just show it on primetime, right? And it was huge. And of course, the X-Files parodies it in this very clever way, in a way that's really... Is that one of the Gilligan episodes? Is that one of the Vince Gilligan ones? It might not be.
I don't know. I know the list of the Darren Morgan episodes in my head. I don't know if I have the Vince Gilligan ones memorized. I'll take a look at that while you talk about it.
All right. Well, the Vince Gilligan ones, the handful of them that the standalone ones are brilliant. Postmodern Prometheus, and there's a bunch that are just fantastic. But so I think X-Cops is a really good indication of what I'm getting at here, which is that...
it is Vince Gilligan. You are right. You are
great.
Correct.
How about that? The tension between Mulder and Scully, this whole like science versus religion idea, again, the 1990s itself was an interesting time in the way that religion played out in the world, because it was a time when we started seeing people move away from religion in a way that... had been kind of predicted for a long time since the 19th century. It was a time when educated adults were having conversations being like, religion's going to be totally dead in 20 years. Right? Like, no one's going to, it's almost over. We're going to have a completely secular generation coming up. And like, that hasn't played out. here we are 25 years later, and it's not the way it's played out. But, you know, there's a reason why people were saying that. And that all changed with 9/11, which I think sort of put religion right back into the sort of centrality of the public awareness. So what we're left with is this really interesting sort of artifact of this period of time. I see how you are intrigued by that. What I think is really interesting about, in particular, what the X-Files does, which is kind of sneaky, is it sets it up as, you know, Scully is the rationalist, right? Like, Scully is the foil to Mulder's
right.
conspiracy theory. Like, I believe, like, all the aliens, you know, he's almost the Ancient Aliens guy, but without the hair, right? Like, everything's aliens. It's always aliens. And Scully is like the no, Mulder, there's a scientific explanation for this, right? But what the show does that's so clever, I think, and one of the reasons why I think it's worth talking about what it's trying to say and like what that character does, is that that's actually not at all what Scully is, right? She is the one who doesn't believe the very thing that's happening in front of her. Like, Mulder's right about all the aliens, right? That's sort of the conceit of the show, is that he is just basing what he believes on observation and fact, and she's the one who's like, no, it's got to be science that's doing it. And then also, right, she's the religious one. And so why it's so clever is it's saying like, yeah, what we think of as being rational and what we think of as being mainstream, you know, doesn't necessarily even hold water. And so the transition of Scully becoming sort of doubling down on her faith following her father's death and her own abduction and miraculous recovery and all that sort of thing, I think it says something important about that relationship, about science and religion. Are you one of the people who thinks that, I mean, what is your personal sort of take on the idea? Like, are science and religion enemies? Is one trying to out like, destroy the other? Can they be compatible? Like, what's your basic, I don't know, sort of gut feeling about that?
Can you, before I answer this, can you explain to me what a Christian scientist is? Because I know the term and I have no idea what it actually is.
Yeah, maybe we'll do an episode about it at some point in the future. A Christian scientist is not a Christian who is also a scientist, and is also not to be confused with a Scientologist, which has nothing to do with science or Christianity. A Christian scientist is a movement that began in, oh God, I'm gonna might get this wrong, but I think the late 19th century. I may have to look it up. It is a sort of Protestant kind of revivalist quasi kind of mystical movement that essentially what they believe is that everything can be cured through prayer and faith. So they put faith front and center in terms of like the well-being of life. I'm way underselling what it is, but the reason why Christian scientists are well known is because they often refuse medical treatment, and that has led to some lawsuits, especially with parents who like let their children die because they don't allow doctors to treat them. So like they reject gotcha. Modern medicine and put it all into God's hands, so to speak. And so they believe that Jesus can heal all wounds, including, one would imagine, pediatric cancer, right? So,
yeah. So it's almost like ironic, unintentionally so.
No, because the word science itself just means knowledge, right? And so it's the root of it. And so, like, the idea of Christian science is the idea of trying to get to the sort of revealed knowledge inherent in Christianity. It's not that. It definitely isn't like Christianity that is sort of geared towards science. It's in fact kind of the opposite. But interesting question. Again, it's a fascinating topic, and I think it's worth maybe doing an episode about it at some point. But yeah, there's a lot of episodes
so
ahead.
So going back to your question,
number one,
do I think that they're out to get one another? I don't think they are. I think that if you run into anyone who is, and I'm not sure if I'm using the word right, but like fundamentalist, like where it's just like this is like people who take the Bible literally as opposed to metaphorically, I think that they are the ones that are going to have an issue with science, and science is going to have an issue with them. And I think that if you take the Bible or any kind of theology as a metaphor and as just like a, hey, here's a guideline to being a good person, I don't think that they're diametrically opposed. Like I basically asked, I think I remember vaguely what the conversation was like, but I remember asking in high school, like our minister, because I went to church until I was like 18, then I went off to college and just sort of like strayed. And I remember asking her like, so, like, how did dinosaurs fit into this? Because, like, the Bible says, you know, 6,000 years or whatever, and, like, it's, you know, science is different. She's like, you know, it's a metaphor. Just, don't take it literally, right? Like, don't be dumb. Like, she wasn't saying don't be dumb about it, but, like, I think that there is, if you're an understanding, empathetic person, I think that religion does a lot of good, and I think that science does a lot of good, and I don't think that they necessarily can't be, it's not that you can't believe in both. I just think that from the outside, it seems like they shouldn't necessarily coalesce. And I think that when you're in the event of like a Dana Scully or like a character like this, I think when you're writing someone archetypally, I think it doesn't really jive, right? Like it's just like, oh, they're so fundamentally opposed, especially early on when like you're not sure what the character is going to become. Like the Scully in season 1 is not at all the Scully in season 9 or 10 or 11 or, you know, whatever they wound up with when they revived it, right? Like it's a very different character. The character grows as all TV characters grow over time. But, you know, when you're writing early on and you know what she basically is, you inject that kind of, I think, infighting sort of inside her as a, oh, we can go somewhere with this, right? And I think that there's something interesting there. But I also, I don't think that if you're rational, if you think about it, I don't think that they're out to necessarily get one another. I think, you know, there are people who take one thing either too strongly, that like scientists who like just make fun of religion or whatever, or religious people who like don't believe science, like the other, like both of those things are crazy, right? I think if, as long as you're able to think sort of down the middle and sort of see both sides. I don't think there's any reason why they can't get along.
Yeah, and so I think one of the things that's really interesting about the way that those two characters play out over the course of the show, you know, I said early on that there's this sort of inversion that you're sort of it's sort of a shell game, right, where it's like here is the rational one and here is the irrational one, and it's like, well, it's not actually really what's happening. It also, like, the way that the religious element of those two characters is explored, I think, is really fascinating, because Scully is sort of like, science has all the answers, and everything can be explained rationally, except in the world of the X-Files, where it can't, right? And at the same time, it's like, yeah, and I'm also going to have this religious component, and you don't question me on that, like, because I'm okay with doing that, and I can make these two things sort of fit comfortably, and I will question them as I please. On the other hand, right, Mulder is, you know, as we said, the true rationalist of the two of them, like the one who actually is just like going on the evidence and what he has experienced and what he's seen. But at the same time, a lot of his motivations and a lot of sort of the long-term story arcs are really sort of caked in religious ideas and religious motifs. You know, like his whole like resurrection sequence in the later seasons, that he dies and returns from the dead, right? That he has this mysterious father figure who's like not his real father, which has very biblical elements to it. His insistence that his sister is still out there somewhere and he will find her, and like there's this zealousness about him, right? And then also, like, there's even the language of, I think it's in the movie where one character says, like, I think it's the cigarette smoking man, is if you kill Mulder, you turn hit one man's quest into a crusade, right? And so, like, yep. Using that crusade language, I think it's really interesting that the writers and Chris Carter in particular really don't just like have this duality of like rationality versus zealotry and religious versus not religious, but sort of shows how there are elements of both of those things on these sort of opposite poles, just sort of playing out in very, very different ways, right? And in some ways, like, Mulder is the more religious of the two of them. It's just that his religion is this massive global conspiracy that he is absolutely determined to uncover. So I think that's really fascinating. I think that's something about the 90s that is being sort of portrayed there. This was a time when belief, belief in like UFOs and aliens, I would imagine, was at its highest in the 1990s.
Well,
right?
A lot of that is also because of Fox, like Alien Autopsy running
sure.
That on prime time. Like, why is that happening?
Right, and sightings and like the countless shows about alien abductions and like Fire in the Sky, and you know, it was this was all the 90s. I think the reason that it was happening was because of a combination of a growing mistrust in institutions, but also like it was a pretty good time economically, especially in America, and when things are going well, people have more time to think about aliens. That's really true, right?
Yeah.
When 9/11 happened, it suddenly didn't seem that much interesting. Like, aliens didn't really seem like a threat, right? When there's no Soviet Union in the 90s, right? The Cold War has ended. There's no Al-Qaeda hadn't risen yet, and so like, where's your existential threat? Well, it must be from space. I think that plays a role. There's a reason why Fox was airing all of those shows. They weren't sort of creating the zeitgeist. They were just tapping into it, right? And that's, you know, when I say that the X-Files is of the 90s, like, that really is what I'm talking about.
I think there's a kind of a beautiful irony to the Mulder and Scully dynamic, and I think everything you've been saying over the last 10 minutes, like, every time you talk, it basically is leading to this, that, like, I think the iconic image or the iconic sort of mission statement or creed in the series is "I want to believe," right? Like, and it's Mulder's, like, it's on the poster in Mulder's office. And, like, by the way, side note, I've been looking for, like, a good recreation of that poster basically my entire life, and it feels like everyone, like, on Etsy is just like, oh, that's not the font. Like, I can tell, like, that's not the font. Like, give me a real one, please. Thank you. I will pay money for it. But I think that there's a beautiful kind of irony that, like, his post or his thing is, I want to believe, but, like, he has no problem believing. Like, he believes. He knows. Like, it's beyond belief. He knows. And it's almost like Scully wants to believe, right? Like, she's the one who's like, I want to see what you're seeing, I just can't. And I think that for the ideas and the motto and the, you know, belief set that is so fundamentally, inherently, seemingly tied to Mulder is actually her, right? Like, she's the one who, like, he's already committed, like you've been saying all along, like, he's the one who has the vision. He knows, you know, since he was a little boy and, like, his sister Samantha got taken, like, he knows that there's something out there that, like, you know, he wants to prove it. Like, he wants, I want to prove, basically, is his thing, right? Like, I want to prove that either the government knew or that there's aliens or whatever. And she's like, look, I can help you prove it, but, like, I want to believe, like, I want to be there with you. And I think there's, like, a really kind of wonderful juxtaposition and sort of maybe irony, and maybe in that seeming Alanis Morissette word, I don't know, but where it's tied to him, but it's not really him. Like, that's not his thing. He knows. It's really her.
Yeah, and you know, when you mentioned fundamentalism earlier, and, you know, if you think about Mulder as kind of essentially a fundamentalist, right? That the idea of certainty in religion is also a really, I think, worthy topic, because it certainty itself is the opposite, really, of faith, right? Like, you can't have faith if you're certain about something. There's no challenge. Like, if you absolutely know God exists and absolutely know that every word of the Bible is inherently true, then you don't have faith. So I think one of the things that we tend to do as a culture is conflate the ideas of faith, religion, and theism, like, all into one thing. Which isn't the case, right? Like, Buddhism is a religion. It is not really a faith, and it doesn't really have a theology. But it definitely is a religion. So, you know, it's sort of a minefield when you even talk about what religion means. And so, when people in the 90s were saying, like, religion's going to be dead in 20 years, I think part of the reason why people thought that was, again, because things were going really well. Right? Like, we weren't in any major wars at the time, and there was no 9/11, and there was no Soviet Union, and it's like, yeah, everybody's just going to be rational from now on, and, you know. But also, like, it's just, it's missing that there is so much nuance in religion, that most people who are religious are not fundamentalists. And in fact, when you talked to your pastor about, you know, what's up with dinosaurs, right? what is your sense? Like, what is your sense about sort of the history of, let's just use Christianity as an example, that, like, how long into the course of Christianity do you think most Christians have believed that, like, you must believe every word of the Bible is absolutely true, and that the story of creation in Genesis 1 and 2 are a historical account? Like, what is your sense of how many people believe that, and for how long that's been going on? I'm just asking you in terms of, like, what do you have in your head as, like, what that looks like?
I wonder. I feel like it probably goes hand in hand with just the proliferation of information in general. Like, before, you know, Gutenberg made the printing press or whatever, right? Like, people just like, oh yeah, like, the Bible says this, I gotta believe it. Like, and then, I don't know if it's David Cross or someone, there's some comedian who's just like, oh no, that's bullshit. Like, it's just like, there's a certain sense where, like, when you can prove something is right, like, you can be like, I'm gonna, like, flip through a book or just bring it up on your phone or whatever, like, there comes a certain point where you say, oh no, like, that's not true. Like, it didn't start 6,000 years ago. Like, I know that, like, this guy didn't live to be 900 years old or whatever. Like, that's just not, like, that's not right. Like, that's not factual. Like, you could take it however you want to mean it, but I feel like it probably, I would imagine, with no basis for this other than just, like, gut feeling, that for a while people, you know, sort of took comfort in that. Because I think what you keep saying, like, you know, in the 90s when people weren't worrying about things, they thought religion was going to die, and then, you know, 9/11 happens, and now what we're going through now, and it feels like, in all things, whether it's just nationwide or global issues, or just the fact that like you're getting older and like you're 60 or 70, you're like, oh, I'm going to die soon, and I want to be at peace with myself and feel like, just let myself believe that there is more than this and more than just this, that I'm going to go somewhere when I die, so I'm going to return to church. Like, I think there's always going to be a fundamental purpose for religion. It might not be as big or as celebrated or as popular as it once was, but I feel like the peace that it gives people will always have merit and have a place in society. But I think that as time goes on and people understand more about the world and know that the world, like, as the world kind of gets smaller, I think there's less of a need for people to be like, oh, this is, I have to live my life this way. Like, I understand more about how things work. This isn't literal. This is metaphorical. This is just a guidebook or whatever.
Yeah. So, okay, that's a really interesting perspective. It's pretty complicated. I'm glad you brought up Gutenberg, because that really is kind of a turning point, right? Without people having pretty ready access to the Bible in a printed form, which the printing press, Gutenberg's printing press, allowed for, you know, for centuries, they had just done what the church told them, and the Catholic Church was the church in Western Europe. And the church would say, yeah, this book here says to do that, right? And so it's like, oh, okay, well, why do I have to take communion, and why do I have to go to church every Sunday, and why do I have to confess to this priest, and why do I, right, all that sort of thing. And it's like, oh, yeah, it's in this book. Just, we read it for you. Don't worry about what it says. It's here, right? And, you know, it's not. Like, there's a lot of stuff that isn't in that book. They shouldn't have said that it was. The answer for why the Catholic Church does stuff is more complicated than the Bible says so. But they basically, like, used this book as, like, oh, this is the source material for all of that, right? And so when people started reading it, they were like, oh, that's not in there, right? Like, they've been lying to us all this time about what's actually in the book. I think so interesting about that is that that's such a sort of scientifically minded thing to do, right? Is to like, oh, here's what I've been told. Now that I have access to this evidence, I am going to weigh what I've been told against the evidence and come to a different conclusion. And that's exactly what Martin Luther did, right? He was like, huh, right? Like, nothing that my church has been telling me is in here. So, you know, Martin Luther in some ways is like almost a, you know, very much a Fox Mulder type, right? Like, he's a guy who's like on a mission to like reveal the truth about the world and take down the man. And it's really hard actually to find much of a difference, except I don't think Mulder is a raging anti-Semite, but like to find a difference between Martin Luther and Fox Mulder in their zeal, right? In their intellect, in their like ability to stand up to a power that wants maybe to kill them. So it's, you know, is that what it means to be religious or not? It's, you know, it's sort of like where does the religion part even fit into these to these people and what they're doing? And when we talk about the sort of the literal interpretation of the Bible, right, this is, I think, something that a lot of people kind of get wrong, that the assumption was that the world is 6,000 years old because the Bible says so, and like that's why I'm going to believe it. For most of Western history, you had no reason to really not believe that, right? Like, if you lived in 13th century France, you didn't have any information that would make you think that that wasn't true. So, like, it was good enough. there was no sort of counterbalancing evidence. But what you need to understand is that when that evidence was unavoidable, when it became, like, you know, publicly aware that
like when carbon dating becomes a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Right. When it's like, no, it is definitely not the case that the Earth is covered in a dome with stars attached to it, as the Bible says, right? Like, okay, well, let's reassess that. And you don't necessarily have to throw God out with it. And while there was a lot of tension, mostly having to do with the continued power of the Catholic Church and institutions and that sort of thing that are built on the validation of religious ideas, it wasn't the mainstream, it was never the mainstream thought that every word in the Bible is literally true or else the whole thing has to be thrown out. Right? And so what we now think of as fundamentalism, the sort of the strand of Protestant Christianity that we associate with people like Jerry Falwell, right, and Pat Robertson, and like the 700 Club and the Left Behind books, which also were a function of the 1990s, which I definitely also will do an episode about at some point, because that
also became a Nicolas Cage movie
and a Kirk Cameron movie, and that shit is nutty, but super fun to talk about. That's new, right? The idea of fundamentalism in that regard is only about 150 years old. It's not traditional. So the embrace of every word in the Bible being literally true, in spite of all the evidence to the contrary, right, is a new phenomenon. And people tend to think that that is sort of the way it's always been, and it really isn't the way that it's always been. So, the Catholic Church for a long time has embraced Darwinian evolution as a scientific fact, the Big Bang Theory as a scientific fact. And when people find out about that, they're like, whoa, really? Right? Like, when Pope Francis, who, like, understands science and, like, studied science, right, is like, yeah, the Big Bang happened. People in the mainstream are like, what? I thought he was a crazy, religious nut job. And no, he's not. Like, yeah, he's pretty religious, right? He's the Pope. But no, he doesn't believe that you have to throw out God by embracing the Big Bang and evolution. Now, I don't know if that's true. Like, I have my own views about that. But certainly, if you're looking at the test case, right, there are very, very religious people who still embrace the ideas of science. And so in that regard, I think we can conclusively say, like, no, they're not enemies. The Vatican has an observatory and, like, have done a lot of great work in astronomy and the like. So, it's complicated.
Like, I don't think it's crazy to believe, to a certain extent, that, like, you can believe that the Big Bang happened and you can have all the scientific proof, but, like, I think that there's also room in there if you want it to be, and if you don't want it to be, you don't have to have it be, but if you want to be like, well, something created the Big Bang, right? Like, it, not just, like, atoms heating up or, whatever, I don't know the Big Bang, I don't understand it. TV show, I don't get it. Like, I know about it, but I don't know, like, actually how it happened. I can't define it. But I don't think that it's crazy to sort of combine that with, to a certain extent, with like there's a higher power that like led to that, right? And I think if you want to believe in both things, I think there's room to, and I think that there's kind of a nice thing there. I think it's, the amazing thing about being human is like you can believe whatever you want to believe if you just try hard enough, right? Like you'd be like, oh yeah, this is all true. Like, what? Sure, why not? Like, as long as you're not like, I really do feel like as long as you're not telling people that they are wrong or that they are dumb. Like, for instance, there are certain people who are very prominent atheists in the TV realm, perhaps like a Bill Maher and a Ricky Gervais type, who are kind of like arrogant and pompous in their like, you're dumb if you believe X, right? Like, it's just, that's not helping anybody. It's the same thing on the other end of the spectrum as like the Jerry Falwell thing, right? Like, this is absolutely fundamentally true, whatever. And as long as you're not doing that, I think you're fine. Like, just like, let people believe, like, it's hard enough to be alive and to be a person. Like, let people believe whatever they want to believe, whether you're a scientist who is struggling with faith because her dad is dying and your partner is like, my sister was abducted by aliens. Or like, if you're just a normal person who's like, I can't refute these facts, but also like, it makes me feel better if I think that there's like a heaven, right? Like, just let people believe what you want to believe. Like, do whatever it takes to get you through this weird thing we call life.
Yeah, and I think what you are describing is something that I sometimes call secular fundamentalism, which is the idea in Bill Maher and Sam Harris and Ricky Gervais, all of whom I like a lot. I mean, it's like not everything about them, but I really enjoy Bill Maher's show. I like the conversations he is able to have, the people he is able to like bring into a room to talk. I think he's really valuable. I think he's very funny. You know, Ricky Gervais obviously has done some brilliant stuff. I like Sam Harris a lot, although I find his attitudes about, like, Islam pretty troubling. But I think he's smart, and I love listening to and reading him and disagreeing with him from time to time. But, you know, I think it proves the point that fundamentalism itself is not a product of religion. It's a product of sort of cultural circumstance, right? The reason that fundamentalism in the Christian capacity, the reason why it was really popular in the 90s with, you know, teenagers wearing, like, what would Jesus do bracelets and that sort of thing, and the rise of the phenomenon of what we'll call, for the sake of argument, Christian rock, though I would argue with the second word there being valid, but, you know, like jars of clay and like all of that
zing.
Crap, right? Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. Zing. There's the phenomenon itself is not tied to religion. It's tied to sort of the escalating changes in society. We always see fundamentalism happen when things are happening really fast and people want to sort of grab on and not let go. Right, so like when in a course of two or three generations, like the entire social fabric changes, right? The pill in the 1960s, right, and then like gay marriage and going to the moon and like all this stuff happening in a very, very short period of time, scares people who grew up with a certain set of sort of religious values and ideas, and their response is often just like grab hold and don't let go, right? So like whatever information comes your way, the earth is 6,000 years old, there is one God, Jesus literally died on a cross and literally like rose again, every word is true, like don't worry about it, right? Like you're gonna have this and it's permanent and you're never gonna, it's never gonna go away. And I think that the sort of secular fundamentalism, which in some ways again is really well portrayed in the Mulder character, that secular fundamentalism is also a product of that. That when you, that sort of, I'm absolutely right and I'm absolutely certain there's not a God and I'm absolutely certain that anybody who believes there is both wrong and also a danger to society, right? Like, is holding everybody back.
Right.
That too is a product of fear, right? It's a product of uncertainty and an unwillingness to live with the nuance. And I think that's why we all love Mulder, but we all love Scully, right? Like Scully is the sort of like comfort zone to all of us. Like if we were hanging out with Mulder all the time, we'd drive ourselves insane, even though he's our hero and like we love him. But like Scully, we could hang out with all the time. Like Scully's the person that it gives us that sort of like chill the hell out, right? And like you can kind of you can live with the uncertainty and you can live with the nuance of reality and that's fine. And I think that's part of the reason why she's such an enduring character. Not only is she great for girls, we can talk a little bit about the Scully effect in a second if you want to, because I think that's really interesting. But she's also just like, she is more like us, right? than she is like the sort of frenetic culture of the 1990s that the rest of the show is sort of portraying. She's grounding in a way, and it's more comforting that you can both be a scientist and also still have a faith, even if it's one that you are sort of doubting yourself, right? Because she doubts her own faith all the time,
yep.
and that's okay. But she still sees a place for it, which is a pretty. Again, at a period of time when everybody's like, religion, who cares, right? Like, it's going to be gone soon. It's pretty remarkable that sort of artifact is still there. And one of the reasons why that show remains, even with the docket seasons, still great, right? And nothing against Doggett and Reyes.
The greatest Terminator.
absolutely the greatest Terminator, but so talk to me a little bit more about your love of Dana Scully and who I assume is like your favorite X-Files character, right? And I assume that John Locke is your favorite Lost character, or is it just like, do you like the dynamic
no,
of like John Locke and Jack and Scully and Mulder. Like, what is it that you like about that so much?
I would say that Scully is for sure my favorite character because, like, the only options, unless you're, like, a real, like, a-hole, like, it's either her or Mulder. Like, if it's, or I guess also maybe Skinner. Like, there's not a lot of options, like, unless you want to be, like, a real pretentious, presumptuous, like, oh, you know, actually, I like Alex Krycek because obviously
I like
he's got such internal.
Man. Yeah, yeah.
You know, like, there's, like, you know, Clyde Bruckman. Like, I like one-offs here and there. Like, they're cool, but, like, it's got to be. Like, Scully's the hardest show.
Fuck Krycek, and if you like Krycek, like, stop listening right now. nobody likes Krycek. People like to see the Krycek, like, punched in the face. That's what they like about Krycek. Like, when he loses an arm, we're like, yeah, okay, cool.
Like, I think what the beauty is with Scully is that she is, like many characters on many shows, she's our way into the series, right? Because, like, Mulder is already established as this X-Files guy, right? Like, he's the one who... He's, for X number of days, like, he's been in the basement just doing the cases nobody else wants. But we're entering the show when she joins him, right? Like, just like how, you know, there's, like, a football story or whatever, like, we follow the kid, like, the new recruit or the new coach or whatever. Like, whatever the way that we're seeing the story, we're connecting with that character. And I think that Scully, from the very beginning, from the pilot episode, we're on her side because we're with her entering this world of the unknown. I think, like, from the beginning, she's meant to be the one that you champion. Like, Mulder is delightful and a weirdo, and I love him, don't get me wrong, but, like, it's all about Scully. Like, Scully's the greatest. Compare that to Lost, where, like, each time that I watch that show or watch the first few seasons or whatever, like, I feel like everyone is wrong, essentially, at some point. Like, the first time I watch it, I'm all about Jack and Kate, and I'm like, because I think, like, you know, like I was just saying about Scully, you wake up with Jack, he's the pilot, he's supposed to be the hero, you're like, oh, he's right, and then you watch it a second time, you're like, oh, no, he's an idiot, he's just, like, thrust in charge, Locke's the one who's, like, who's got the greater, and then, like, you watch it again, you're like, no, they're both dumb, like, it's all about Sawyer, like, he's the only one, he's the right one here, and I don't know that I have my favorite character, I guess, on Lost is Charlie. Like, it's gotta be Charlie. But, like, Charlie's not the emotional resonance. Like, he's got his arcs with Claire and stuff like that. But I think, to your question, my favorite character choosing on the X-Files is easy. It's Scully. But I think in terms of Lost, I don't know that I ever really, like, there is a one watch through where I was like, oh, I'm on Team Locke. Like, I get it. You know, there is something magical happening here that he's able to walk and all this different stuff. Like, I get where he's coming from. I understand his point of view. I think what I appreciate about that is just the dynamics, that there is something more. I think that's maybe a more accurate way to describe what I like about these shows than religion is mythology. And I think that the coincidence in these is that the mythology is tied to religion, right? That it's mythology that, like, there is something, this island has mythical powers that John sees, like, you know, he's the man of faith, and maybe that's not to a god, but it's to a greater something or other, right? And I think that that's what I connect with. It's like the yearning for, like, meaning and the yearning for understanding and development and deeper understanding of the world around you or whatever. And I think that's what really connects me with these shows. Like, the same thing with, like, The Leftovers. Like, The Leftovers has a very literal religious, like, is this the rapture? And then, like, they're like, we're never going to tell you. Like, just good luck. Like, that's, it's not about what happened, it's about what happens after that. And I think it's, again, it's everyone on that show trying to understand not what happened, not why it happened, but, like, what the hell do we do now? And I think that that's what really kind of connects with me. It's like, whether it's a god or whether it is religion or spirituality or whatever, I think what I love about all these shows is that they really show earnestly the search for something, right? Like, whether it's aliens or whether it's religion or whether it's meaning or whether it's purpose, I think in all of those, any character that is, like, searching for something more and not just trying to survive or whatever, I think that's what is really inherently fascinating to me about these shows and these characters.
Well said. And thanks for sharing those thoughts. So I want to end this just with a couple little bits of trivia. So one of the cool things that has happened in the last 20 or so years is what is called the Scully effect. Joey, do you know what the Scully effect is?
I feel like I've heard it, and I probably could define it at one point, but I don't know right now. So why don't you please tell me and the listeners?
So the Scully effect is a phenomenon whereby there was, I think, some sort of anecdotal evidence that the character of Dana Scully and the young women who watched The X-Files as teenagers, or maybe even sort of Joey's age, so like tweens, maybe like, you know, 9 or 10 years old through, let's say, you know, 14, 15, 16, 17, whatever, in that range in the mid-1990s, went on to become scientists themselves. And again, it had been sort of anecdotal for a while, but there was actually studies done and surveys done, and the evidence is pointing that in that actual direction, that there has been a rise in the number of young American women who have studied science and entered the sciences since The X-Files aired, and a lot of them, when asked, say that their inspiration for doing so was Dana Scully. So that's really cool. And, you know, it's also like one of the things that I also sort of speaks to this whole aliens and religion and science and the conflict therein, mm-hmm. Is the movie Contact, which came out also in 1997, which also features like a cool female scientist who discovers aliens, right? So yeah, I think there was quite a bit. I don't want to just say, you know, credit Scully entirely. I think there was the kind of opening of women in the sciences in both that and the X-Files,
yeah.
You know, in a pretty visible way, probably also played a role. And then also just like the fact that a lot of hard work was done to break down gender barriers. But again, like our pop culture reflects where we are,
sure.
In addition to sort of inspiring where we go. So, you know, I don't think I would never undersell it. I think it is an important thing to do. Representation is great. And good on the X-Files for, you know, finally doing that. And if I remember right, and I'm not sure if this is true, but like, I gotta find out whether or not it is one way or the other. You might know this. Was Scully originally written as a male character? Because I kind of think I remember hearing that and them sort of changing their mind at the last minute.
Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't know if I've heard that. I don't know if I forgot that, but that's not something in my brain.
Yeah, it would be like, it would totally be something that like early 1990s Fox would demand. They're like, no, you must have two male leads and they must be at each other's throat and whatever. So maybe I'm wrong, but... either way, thank you to Chris Carter and to the great people at the Fox Network and their sister networks and all the good work that they do for the advancement of knowledge and information and stuff.
Well, the irony there, and I don't know if it's irony is the right word again, but like if it is two dudes, if it's Mulder and just like basically Scully but a dude, that show lasts two or three
yeah.
years, right? Like it's like, oh yeah, we'll give it another shot, just see how it goes.
Yeah, yeah. It would have been like every other show on Fox in the yep. mid-90s that lasted like one or two seasons.
I also do want to credit, you know, like the fact that Gillian Anderson absolutely kills this role, and she was like 25 or 24 when the
oh,
show
I
started.
Know.
She's a baby.
Yeah,
she's a
yeah,
literal
yeah.
baby on this show. And I was like,
yes.
She's so...
She was an actual infant in the first episode.
Yeah, it's amazing.
Yeah,
she grows up right in front of our eyes. But like, it's amazing to me how good she is from the jump. Like, you know, I think she'd been in a few things before that, but like, it's between the fact that like they just wrote her the way that like it was such a strong character to be written, but like the way that she plays it, it's flawed. Like she is so good in that role, and man, oh man,
she's still good in roles. She's still and like it's one of those people that has somehow managed to look better as she's gotten older, which is like good on her. Her and like Julia Louis-Dreyfus and like and I don't know what they're doing, but
yep.
You know, they should not sell it to anybody because. It's working for him. I think it's the same thing that whatever Tom Cruise eats, maybe it's some kind of Scientology thing. Well, of course, Gillian Anderson has the advantage of alien DNA that was injected into her when she was abducted, so that's probably what's happening. you know, in this time of whatever the hell reality we're living in now, with Donald Trump being president and this virus that makes us not be able to talk to people in person. I really just want the days of, like, worrying about UFOs back.
Yeah,
if
man.
Nothing else, that's a good reason to talk about the X-Files right now.
Well, here's a good thing. Here's a good thing. You can still worry about UFOs. I mean, you have other things to worry about, but, like, nothing's stopping you from worrying about UFOs.
It's true. Wouldn't it be great, though, if, like, one of our major pressing social concerns was, like, what's happening at Area 51? Like, you know what? Nothing, because if something were, like, Trump would have blurted it out by now. So, yeah, okay. 90s were great. I miss them. this is not great, but we're going to keep talking and podcasting and thinking about the good things as we work our way through this global pandemic. Anyway, Joey, thanks for joining me and for embarking on this maiden voyage of this podcast. Our theme song is by Bugs in the Corner. You can find them on the Facebooks and the Spotifys and the Bandcamps. That's Bugs, as in the things that crawl on the ground, and In the, as in when you're in something, and it's the, and corner, like a room. Thank you, Joey Lewandowski. Thank you for downloading, tuning. What do you say, Joey? What's the
listening?
Listening? Yeah, listening. Yeah, thanks for listening. The end. All right. Thanks, Joey. Bye.